I'm Owen Bennett-Jones, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. If you Google the words tantric sex, you'll get no fewer than 186,000 websites. Here's a fairly typical example of the sort of thing they say. It's a quote. Why is Tantra so important these days? Tantra is a rich tradition of mutual dignity and respect for women and men, allowing the spiritual connection to open doors to the many secrets stored away in the centuries of tantric tradition. The bullet points underneath might then include things like this. The one-hour orgasm made famous by Sting. Secrets known by White House interns. Well, scholars who've studied Tantra get upset about this kind of thing, pointing out but neither Sting nor your average intern are likely to be interested in some of the things which scholars believe the original practitioners of Tantra did, such as consuming various bodily fluids, including some rather unappealing ones. So why has tantric sex been transformed from an ancient Indian religious ritual into a commercialised, sexualised lifestyle option? And who gets the final word on what Tantra is, the East or the West? 1-800-423-8255. That's the number, 1-800-423-TALK. Now, one of the leading scholars on Tantra is David White. He's a professor of religious studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and he's just published a book, Kiss of the Yogini, Tantric Sex in its South Asian Context, that deals with the origins of Tantra. Professor, thank you for joining us on the programme today. Your book deals
with all
the various interpretations, reinterpretations, different takes on what Tantra is. Can you begin by, let's go right back to the beginning of this in India and tell us when Tantra first emerged?
Tantra first emerged in the latter half of the first millennium of the Common Era, so sometime around the 6th, 7th, 8th century AD. It was a body of practice mainly to control powerful semi-divine, semi-demonic beings, often called yoginis, female beings, by feeding them. And by feeding them, they were appeased, and appeased, they would not steal women's children away, make people sick, give them nightmares, and so on. But there was an inner circle of tantric practice that was observed by a certain elite, of which probably medieval kings and princes and members of the aristocracy would have been a part, that involved transactions in sexual fluids, in which men would offer their sexual fluids to women who represented these yoginis, who in some way embodied them or were possessed by them. And the yoginis, in turn, these women would offer the men their own sexual emissions. It's unclear exactly what was meant by that. It may have been menstrual blood. It may have been fluid of orgasm. For a different reason, that reason being that these women in some way, naturally, biologically, carried in their bodies the germplasm of the divine, the source of all energy and life in the world, something that men didn't have, that men needed in order to become a part of this great family, and this is the term that's used in early Tantra, kula, family or clan, of God, a family that was comprised of these yoginis, these semi-divine, semi-demonic beings.
So these were sexual rituals which were being carried out, practiced by members of the elite in India in what, sort of 6th, 7th, 8th century?
Yeah, that would be the early end of the body of practice. A certain inner circle, that's correct.
And what is the distinction between Tantra and tantric sex? I mean, was the whole thing about tantric sex, or was there a broader philosophy?
There was a broader philosophy. And, of course, you don't find the term tantric sex in the tantras, the sacred canon, the scriptures of this tradition in India of this period. You just have reference to rituals that involve these transactions in sexual fluids. So, as I was saying, it's only this inner circle that would engage in these sorts of practices. They were not the majority practices at any time. However, I'd argue that it is these tantric sexual rituals that were what gives Tantra or gave Tantra its specificity, which made it different from other forms of Hindu or Buddhist religion in India in that period. But the sexual practice was one that centered on the production of sexual fluids, not the orgasm itself, but rather the fluids that were produced that could then be offered to goddesses or consumed by male practitioners.
Now, there's a debate, isn't there, about whether these practices were actually practices, actually happened, people did them, or whether they just wrote about it and thought about it?
Yes, there is. I'm inclined to opt for the former, that they actually did practice them, because there are elaborate descriptions in early tantras of how to do the practice. And there are sculptural representations that on temple walls from the same period that would appear to be depictions of those practices. It need not necessarily be either or. It could be both and. For some persons, depending on their goals and their socioeconomic, or I should say their religious status in the tradition, imagining these rituals was preferable to actually engaging in them. Both were probably the case.
Let me bring in someone else who's very knowledgeable on this subject. Wendy Doniger, Professor of the History of Religions at the University of Chicago. She's joining us from Truro, Massachusetts. And Professor Doniger, I know you've translated many Sanskrit texts into English and you've written on this precise subject of Tantra. Could you just respond to what you've just heard? Do you agree with what you've just heard from Professor White?
Yes, I basically do agree. I think that the texts say certain things about performing rituals in such detail. I think his book is very persuasive that some people must have done them. But I also think that later on in India, and perhaps even at the beginning, but certainly later on, other people just use those texts as a meditational base. So I think you have a wide range of approaches to whether the texts really mean it or don't mean it, even within India itself, even at an early period.
Is this the distinction between hardcore and softcore tantra that you read about in these academic texts on this?
I think not. I think the hardcore tantra is the tantra which is more about sexuality. Some of the later tantric texts don't even write about these rituals at all, but go on in other directions entirely and are much more theoretical and less ritual. So even the hardcore tantra could either be taken hard or soft, as it were.
Tell me about the meditation techniques that I think came after this first phase that we've heard about from Professor White. What form did the meditation take?
Well, there were meditational techniques of all sorts in India. Some were also sexual meditational techniques. That is to say, in the early period, as David White has proven, I think, the whole point of the fluids was to get them out, to get them out of your body and offer them to the goddesses and so forth. But in later Indian texts, and this is the part that became most notorious in Europe later on as well, with Arthur Avalon and that whole crowd, the part of the tantra which is better known in Europe is a meditational technique which was also sexual, which meant that instead of getting the fluids out of your body, you drew them into your body, and you drew them, you being a primarily a male practitioner, you drew the fluids up the spinal cord and into the brain, and you could even use this meditational technique in a sexual context with a woman, and theoretically you could draw her sexual fluids out of her body into your body through the joining of the sexual organs, and then the man would draw her fluids, those magical fluids that David White has written about, and all of it would go up to the brain, not out of the body, but stay in the brain, and various things would happen when you got that stuff in your brain according to different texts.
Right. Professor White, we've started off in 6th, 7th, 8th century where you think these practices were actually going on, and then we've heard about this later phase in India where it became more of a meditational technique, and now I want to bring it forward to the colonial period, because the British turned up in India, took a look at some of this, and were rather flabbergasted and interested, I think.
Yes, indeed they were. And Wendy's already mentioned Arthur Avalon, also known as Sir John Woodruff, who was a British civil servant serving in the court at Calcutta at the turn of the 20th century. And he became the great sort of spokesman for Tantra of a softer variety than the hardcore that I describe in my book. And in a way, he tried to rehabilitate the reputation of Tantra as something not so awful and horrific and off-putting, especially if one has eaten recently a meal. And he quite succeeded in doing so. And in a way, he raised Tantra to the level, justifiably, of a true and authentic philosophical system. However, he was relying more heavily on later developments in the tantric tradition, particularly in the part of India in which he was based, that being Bengal in eastern India. And also, distinction has to be made between the goals of different tantric practitioners. There are those who seek power in the world, and these were the ones who would have likely engaged in the more hardcore practices, and those who sought and seek a form of liberation through meditative practice. This latter group often being Brahmins, persons of the highest caste, whose concerns for bodily purity would prohibit them from engaging in the sort of sexual practices that I describe in my book, yet who nonetheless wanted to have another form of access to the divine and to the absolute, and that could be had according to their commentarial tradition on those original ritual texts through a more soft core meditative form of practice. What the British were confronted with when they came to India was all of the above.
Right, so Arthur Avalon was a pen name. Is that
yes,
right?
Yes, it was.
And the real name was this administrator, Sir, what did you say?
John Woodruff.
Right.
When he published his own works, he signed them John Woodruff. When he published in collaboration with other scholars, often Indians, he used his pen name.
Okay, so he then wrote these books about Tantra, and did they find a market, and what sort of period are we talking about precisely here?
We're talking about the first half of the 20th century, and many of those books are into their 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th printing, so they still have a market. They're classics of the opening of the door of Tantra to the West from India. He was really a pivotal figure.
So he thought this was a good thing, did he?
He did, and in this he was influenced by a Bengali, that is the people of Bengal, intelligentsia that itself was dabbling somewhat in a dilettante manner in Tantra. There was a tantric revival in that part of India that had begun in the 16th, 17th century, and it was much more intellectualized and cerebralized and much cleaner than the sort of Tantra that I see as having been important in an earlier period.
So the revival was all about meditation, you think?
By and large it was, yes. That's what the texts are mainly talking about. And the worship of particular goddesses, again, for goals of power, but not in these horrific ways, at least to the British mindset.
Right, and just to be... Well, that's what I'm getting confused about, because the British found this abhorrent in some ways, but you're also saying that this guy found it to be a good thing.
Yes, he was quite exceptional in that respect.
And it
was his mission, in a sense, to rehabilitate Tantra in the face of this this general revulsion to the tradition, to its excesses.
Wendy Doniger, you've got a point to make.
I was just going to say that just as there is a wide range of Indians, of Hindus, and also Buddhists in their approach to Tantra, some of whom performed the sexual ritual, some of whom did not, so too there's, of course, a wide range of British reactions to it. You get the British missionaries who think that it's all of Hinduism sort of ghastly and filthy, and you get then people who went native and who thought it was all kind of wonderful. And so you have Arthur Avalon, Sir George Woodruff, really leading a double life. As Sir George Woodruff, he's on the side of the British administration, which by and large is repressing certain aspects of Hinduism and making Hindus themselves feel that aspects of their own religion should be changed and concealed and so forth.
Okay, thanks, Professor. We'll be back to you in a moment just after the break. The number, 1-800-423-8255. Do join us with a call. I'm Owen Bennett-Jones. You're listening to The Connection on NPR. I'm Owen Bennett-Jones in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection, and we're talking about the various incarnations of Tantra from 10th century India to 21st century California, or for that matter, New York City.
I always feel so amazing after yoga. My body feels so open.
Samantha.
Yes.
I'm celibate. I practice brahmacharya, tantric celibacy. I gave up sex 3 years ago.
Now you're just being cruel.
No. It was all ego. And where I am now is so much better than sex.
Oh, come on, honey. Nothing's better than sex.
Think about really good foreplay. The sexual energy is just starting to awaken. Now imagine a 3-year foreplay.
My apartment's just around the corner.
That was Samantha from an episode of Sex in the City. The number, if you want to join in, is 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. Now, let's go to West Sedona, Arizona for a moment, because on the line I have Baba Dez. Now, he describes himself as a transformational guide who's been trained in the sacred healing arts, and he runs sessions with men, women and couples to activate, strengthen and deepen their tantric skills. So we're moving on from the British colonial period in India right up to date with current practice in the United States. Baba Dez, you're a specialist in Tantra, right?
Yes.
And tell us about your background then. Where did you train to learn about it?
My training comes from different teachers who studied in India I was living in Hawaii in the 80s, and so there was a group of several different teachers there. And then also studying with different energy masters, spending a lot of time reading, meditating. A lot of the information, a lot of the insights comes from meditation and prayer.
Have you been to India to consult people there?
I actually have not.
Right. But you consider yourself now to be an expert in Tantra.
Well, you know, I mean, I definitely know what I know and I don't know what I don't know.
Right. Okay, so I don't know if you heard our earlier conversation. I mean, the original form of Tantra back in the 8th, 9th centuries involved these exchanges of bodily fluids and so on. What are you practicing, and what's your understanding of how it differs from the origins of Tantra?
Well, I feel like Tantra is a vast body of knowledge, and it's really a science of living, and living and loving and manifesting and health and vitality. And so I feel like there's a lot of different arms, a lot of different branches of Tantra, and because it encompasses all of humanity and all of the excesses and all of the reserves, it really covers the whole base. And so, how do we honor the individual, and how do we support the individual to express what is divine for them in a way that adds value to their life and to the planet?
Right. It's quite New Agey.
Well, it can be New Agey, but then again, I feel like it's really spiritual. It's spiritual, and it not only encompasses the traditions and traditional religious thoughts, but also perhaps a lot of new thought also.
Do you believe in God, then?
I do, personally, yes.
A tantric God?
I believe in a God that is, I guess if Tantra means that it encompasses all of life and all of everything, then yes.
How many people do you have coming to your workshops, and why do they come?
Oh, you know, it depends on the area. Maybe there'll be anywhere from 20 to 50 people in an event, and they come to learn more about how to live and love and create more ease and beauty and abundance in their lives.
Right, that's quite vague. I mean, can you give us an example of a sort of, I don't know, in your last seminar, what jobs did the people have who were coming?
Well, for instance, one of the things that we do in the events is we teach people how to communicate better with themselves and each other. So there'll be some meditative practices so they can be more aware of their breathing, what's happening in their bodies, what's happening in their hearts, what's happening in their minds, what's happening with their emotions. As they get more in touch with what's happening with themselves, then, of course, they're able to communicate more fully who they are to another being and also be able to receive what's going on with their partner.
Why is this important for Americans, do you think?
Well, it's important because Americans seem to be living a very accelerated lifestyle, and oftentimes it feels like we get a little bit disconnected, and sometimes very much disconnected, from our emotions and our hearts. And if we're not able to connect with our feelings and our thoughts and our emotions and our hearts, then it kind of short-circuits the ability to truly manifest our desires.
You haven't mentioned much about tantric sex or indeed the consumption of bodily fluids. That's not part of your thinking.
Well, I wouldn't say that it's not part of my fluids or not part of my thinking. However, I would say that I don't really cut it out. You know, it's part of life, it's part of living and part of loving, and one of the most powerful things we can do when we make love, of course, is to create another life or to procreate. And we have an opportunity to take that kind of powerful energy, that creative energy, and channel it into other things that we may want to manifest other than, let's say, a child. We could manifest, like I say, health, ease, and abundance for ourselves or someone else.
Okay, Barbara Dez, thanks very much for joining us from West Sedona, Arizona, with the contemporary take on Tantra. Let's go to a call now. I've got Jay in Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
Hi, how are you?
Hi.
It's really interesting that this conversation is going on, and I'm originally from India, and I wouldn't say I'm an expert in Hinduism, but as far as my 28 years of life, I haven't seen anybody actually practice Tantra, as a matter of fact, and neither any gurus around or any spiritual leaders, as a matter of fact, who are recognized by the society ever, you know, say that it is a way to reach spiritualism, though it is. I'm not saying it is not. But the thing is that everybody has to decide what is right and wrong. And as far as Hinduism, evolution over the last decades has occurred, and accordingly, it has been found that it is better to reach spirituality to better means than going through Tantra because of the fact that it involves basically demon worship. As a matter of fact, sex is not the most important thing in life, though it is a part of life, and it should not be given undue importance, because then your focus loses from reaching spiritualism and gains on just having sex.
Are you saying that the tantric tradition in India is dead now, really?
I wouldn't say that. There might be people who practice it because it's a democratic country and it's a vast, you know, majority of people. But it's not prevalent, or it's not encouraged, because of the fact that it not only involves sexual activities, but includes other types of vices like drinking and sacrifice and eating flesh, even of human beings sometimes.
Right. Let's put that to Professor White. Is that an aspect of Tantra, cannibalism?
It appears in certain textual traditions, and there are rumors I've heard from many persons, particularly in eastern India, of cannibalism being a part of tantric ritual. On occasion, I've been told, people from with limited economic means will leave the body of a deceased family member out at night on the eve of the cremation ritual, because Hindus burn their dead. And on that night, the body will disappear mysteriously, and people will say that this was because a tantric practitioner took the body in exchange for some financial compensation given to the family in order to use it for tantric rituals. This doesn't necessarily imply cannibalism, but certain body parts, particularly the skull, are important in certain tantric ritual practices. I could follow up on what the caller was saying. Tantra has always meant many things to many people, and he's speaking from the sensibilities of very likely someone of an urban background from the Indian intelligentsia, whose take on Tantra is very different from that of village Indians, who, it must be recalled, comprise 80 to 85% of the Indian population. And while they may not refer to what they're doing as Tantra, it is of a piece with that ancient tradition of basically making offerings to these powerful, petulant beings who would otherwise steal your children away, cause miscarriage, nightmares, etc., etc. So yes.
Yeah, let me bring in Professor Doniger here on this question of the extent to which, if at all, Tantra is being practiced today in India and maybe in Nepal as well, right?
Well, I think there are several different things going on in these allegations of cannibalism and of whether people are actually doing it, and if so, what they're doing. I think certainly there are certain tantric rituals which are being practiced today. There's evidence of that in David White's book and in other books as well, particularly in Bengal and in parts of Nepal and Assam as well. At the same time, there's a mythology of Tantra among these urban classes, these intelligentsia, which is not unlike the mythology that we know in Europe about witches and about other groups, which is that these people are performing cannibalistic acts and so forth, and there's a vision of the antinomian, law-breaking things that certain people are doing, which is a very popular vision, whether or not it has anything to do with what people are actually doing in India. And that's a very old idea, that they are sleeping with their sisters, that they are performing cannibalistic acts and so forth. So I'm nervous about taking that seriously without pretty good evidence of it. And, of course, it's the sort of thing of which there almost never is evidence for. It reeks to me of a kind of mythology, the extreme things, whereas I think the less extreme, the simple sexual acts and meditation on them is most likely certainly going on. And there is better data for that, too, that, in fact, some people are doing certain of these tantric acts. But the cannibalistic data is thin, if existent at all. And I'm not convinced by that.
Okay, let's take another call. Beth from Belmont, Massachusetts.
Hi there.
Hi.
I'm a novelist. I have written a novel about tantric sex and tantra, which I researched rather extensively over the past couple of years. I have sent it to a number of literary agents and to a number of publishers, and almost universally they say the subject matter is too hot. They will not handle it. And I'm wondering, what exactly is it that they're so afraid of? There's so many sex manuals published. You know, you're doing a show about Tantra itself, and yet they say that it's not something that they feel comfortable doing. I wanted to know what the guests think about that.
Yeah, well, Professor White, you got your book published, no problems?
No, because it purports, and it is, a scholarly study of a historical development over several centuries. However, I also have tried my hand at fiction writing, and I've had the same sorts of frustrations. I wasn't writing specifically about tantric sex in India or an imaginary India. But it does seem to be, there are certain areas of the exotic and the erotic that publishers do seem to be uncomfortable with.
Wendy Doniger, have you come across that as well with publishers?
I have not tried to publish my fiction. I'm more cautious than David is. I generally keep my fiction to myself. So I've written it, but I haven't tried it out. But I have found that some of the writings I've done in an academic way about sexual aspects of Indian religion have met with hostility from Hindus, who believe that Hinduism is purely spiritual, and that a Western writer like myself, who writes scholarly books about its eroticism, is eroticizing it and is distorting the tradition. And I've had hostile reactions to my academic book for that reason.
That's right. Didn't I read you had an egg thrown at you?
In London, in your land, I did indeed.
Because you had upset people because they think that you are misrepresenting their religion?
Not even just misrepresenting. Part of the emails, I had some hostile emails, were simply saying that I chose things that they didn't know were in their scriptures. They weren't even saying that they weren't there, but that the passages I was writing about were passages that they preferred to ignore. So in translating the Kama Sutra, for instance, which I have done, the Kama Sutra has existed for a long time. I didn't invent it, but it was regarded as a wrong choice to have made, to choose to translate that book rather than to translate one of the more spiritual texts of India. So it wasn't just a matter of misrepresentation, but misemphasis, bringing out things that should be left alone.
Michael from Watertown, Massachusetts.
Yes. Hi. I was wondering if change in the Indian attitude correlated at all with the Mughal conquest or also to the British conquest, because I've observed that at least a lot of the time it looks like conquered peoples tend to become puritanical and religiously scrupulous and orthodox. Also, I'd like to put in a plug for a book called Karma Kola.
Okay, well, you've done that. Thank you. Thank you very much. What about that question of puritanism and how attitudes in India itself changing? Professor White.
Yeah, I think that is the case in India, and very much so in the British period. The Indian elite, the intelligentsia, the urban Indian population, sought to prove itself to be worthy of its colonial power, and sought to be more Protestant than the Protestants, and to make render Hinduism something attractive to the British. And in a sense, much of the post-colonial forms that Hinduism has taken, particularly among non-resident Indian populations, but also urban elites, is very much the fruit of that that reaction to the colonial presence.
So, Professor, I mean, you've written this book. It's just out. It does describe some of the sexual practices in detail. Do you expect to receive hostility as a result of that?
I have, to some extent, actually in the wake of a very favorable review that I thank Wendy Doniger for having written in the Times Literary Supplement. There has been somewhat of a campaign against my book and some ad hominem attacks on me over internet, but it hasn't gone beyond that at this point. And it is by sort of the usual suspects.
Right. Who are they?
Non-resident Indians who consider themselves to be spokespersons for a vast constituency, which is, in fact, people like themselves.
Sorry, these are people who live in the States or live in India?
In India. In the States, by and large.
Right, and they're objecting on the grounds that we heard about earlier, basically that you are misrepresenting their faith.
Yes, that's correct. Whereas what I'm attempting to do is to reproduce the historical period in the history of their faith, which in no way reflects on Hinduism as constituted today, at least the Hinduism that they practice.
But I guess there is common ground between the new, I mean, you and the Hindu, puritanical Hindu take on this, in that both of you would disagree with the New Age version of Tantra that's out there, particularly in California.
Yes, you're right about that. I think we disagree for different reasons. The Hindu fundamentalists or the people I was speaking of take issue with sex, and I take issue with tantric in the term tantric sex. I say that people like Baba Dez are probably doing a great service to their clientele, yet I take issue with the fact that they're calling it tantric because, for a number of reasons that perhaps we can get to after the break, there is very little of tantra in the tantric sex that's found on the internet and in these New Age workshops and so on.
Thanks, Professor. Stay with us. And Professor Doniger, too. We're talking about the joy and politics of tantra and tantric sex. Who gets to say the last word in the definition of tantra? And if you want to join in, it's 1-800-423-8255. You're listening to The Connection on NPR. I'm Owen Bennett-Jones, in for Dick Gordon, and this is The Connection. Well, this hour we're talking about the globalisation and appropriation of the ancient Indian tantric religion. With us this hour, Wendy Doniger, Distinguished Professor of History of Religions at the University of Chicago, and also David White, who's just written Kiss of the Yogini, Tantric Sex in its South Asian Context. If you want to join in, the number 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's take a call now. Bert from Free Union, Virginia. Bert.
Yes, sir. I'd like to bring up a different slant on this, using sexual arousal as a focus in hardcore meditation is very likely to create a neurophysiological explosion known as a Kundalini awakening. And this can be pretty scary, and some people have flashbacks just as they would from psychedelic use. And I hear so little about this except in the New Age press, but there's a spiritual emergency network out there to help people through this. This is real. I think the medical community ought to study it more, but I'd like some feedback on that aspect of Tantra.
Professor White.
I'm not too familiar with this. It is the case that in the commentarial tradition on the rituals that we've been talking about, you have a shift from the production of sexual fluids to an emphasis on the psychochemical, psychophysiological effects of orgasm. And this is the mind expansion that the New Age has picked up on to a great extent in its appropriation of tantric sex. That is maintain a secondary development. I don't really know about the Kundalini awakening experience that the caller is referring to and what dangers it represents for persons engaging in that.
Professor Doniger, are you familiar with this?
Well, I'm familiar with the texts that write about it, but I've never actually spoken to anyone who used it in a sexual ritual. But certainly there is, in many aspects of Indian religions, Buddhism as well as Hinduism, a very subtle psychological understanding of different sorts of consciousness that Western and European and American religious traditions are really just beginning to discover. And in fact, some of them do have medical analogs and are interesting to science. So I wouldn't be surprised if there wasn't a way of physiologically tabulating and studying these altered states. But I don't know that it has been done within the Indian traditions. They write about them. They say it happens. The commentaries warn you about them. There are warnings in the tantric text. There were warnings in the Kama Sutra about the powers of sexual arousal. We know about those dangers in our own way also. So there are forces at work here. Sex is a very powerful part of human lives, and if it goes wrong, bad things can happen. And the Indian texts know about that, too.
Vajpayee from Cedar Falls, Iowa.
Yeah, my first thing I want to say, I'm familiar with the writing of professor from Chicago, and I have the greatest respect for her. I'm not familiar with your guest writings, but both seem to complain that there is a kind of resentment on the part of Hindus, and especially, quote, Hindus who are here, that their religion is being depicted in a wrong manner. I have an argument with this. It is not that what you talk about that we resent. It is what you depict, that it is the only part of Indian civilization. For centuries, Christian missionaries, Western scholars have depicted only the horrifying aspects of Indian civilization, especially the Hindu civilization. So, for example, when you go to Khajuraho temple, lots of people never tell that Hindus believe in four stages of life, and Khajuraho temples depict them. The only thing you can buy, see the books, is the sexual part of it. And that's what we resent. There are artha kama moksha. Kama is an essential part. But talk about and emphasize about other good parts of India too. I'm not saying that Professor Wendy Flaherty does. She is a wonderful specimen of good writing. But there are lots of people, including Christian missionaries. Second part I want to tell. I'm from a village, and I'm very proud of that. I'm not part of that urban India, which always sits in coffee houses and talks about whatever they don't know. I have seen and I have read tantric some practices, and of course they do not represent the high order or the original tantric practices they meant to be. They are the distorted practices. And once in a while, a Western, well, first thing, they don't get to see it, but if they do, and they just say, that's it.
I see. So you think it's a distorted vision?
Yeah,
and as a bit of
distorted vision.
Okay, well, stay with us, and let's just get Professor Doniger's response to that.
I certainly agree that that anyone who says this is all that India is about, this is all that Hinduism is about, is distorting the tradition. I just feel that I've been very careful, and many of David White has certainly been very careful, and many of the good scholars writing about India who have been attacked for that tiny part of their writings, which does deal with the sexual aspects of India, and that the wider range that all of us do write about, which does deal with moksha, which does deal with other aspects of Hinduism, have been ignored in these attacks. So on the one hand, there are people, Christian missionaries and others as well, who only write about one thing, but then there are also attackers who only write about the one thing. And so I think in both cases there's an inappropriate narrowing of the vision, and what we're all trying to do is to say this is one piece of the puzzle. It's not the whole thing. It's something worth seeing, though.
Oh, sure. It's a part of a great civilization, and that's the way it should be represented.
Yes.
Not some gory affair that a bunch of Indians are doing this. And I have heard and seen that kind of aspect. I'm not saying you, because as I said, I have the greatest respect for his scholars, from Max Muller to other people. I have a degree in Sanskrit, and I have read things in original. But it bothers me that sometimes those are the kinds of things which you hear in the churches and the small towns which are written, and that's what we Hindus resented.
Okay, thanks very much, Vajpayee. Let's go to David now from Burlington in Vermont.
Oh.
Hi.
Wonderful show. I wanted to ask the the folks on the air, if they can address, with all due respect to Eastern Tantra, the connection between the Western occult traditions and Tantra. It seems to me that in the readings I've done, not actual experience, there is a large school of knowledge with some of the Western occult traditions, Aleister Crowley, OTO, various schools, the Golden Dawn, and some of the more archaic or ancient tantric practices, the exchanging of body fluids and whatnot. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay. Professor White, is there a connection between early tantric practices and the Western occult?
There's a fine book by Hugh Urban on that very subject. I'm blanking on the exact title of it. It's published at University of California Press. Certainly, Aleister Crowley and others in the late 19th, early 20th century were drawing on the then fairly scant Western knowledge of Indian Tantra in some of their own occult writings and practices. I don't think they had a very good understanding, because it was being filtered through, people like Sir John Woodruff and missionaries who really didn't know what this Tantra thing was that they were writing about. It. That's not fair to Sir John Woodruff. He knew quite a bit, but the occultists were appropriating this foreign tradition in much the same way that this tantric sex trade does now in the early 21st century.
Kumar from Newton, Massachusetts.
Yes, I wanted to build on some of the earlier callers' comments. One was that Tantra may be a dying or a dead tradition in most parts of India. And I know from my own experience from South India that that is not true. I have met gurus and been initiated in the South Indian Sri Vidya tradition, which is the so-called right-hand path of Tantra. And I practice both that and also some of the other traditions with regard to the left hand, with regard to the sexual energies. And all of these we can learn and practice even today in India. And I want to also comment on one of the other callers who talked about the dangers of Kundalini rising. And yes, from my own experience, I can say that it is a very powerful energy that needs to be carefully managed and controlled.
Are you saying that the current practice in India is mostly about meditation?
Well, meditation is one aspect, but that gets more into Vedanta. Tantra is more about experiential practices, which can be of the so-called right-hand path, where there is no overt sexual component. It's called Samayachara, and there is the Kaula traditions, which emphasize the sexual energy as a trigger to getting the Kundalini going.
And you're talking about southern India, yes?
In southern India, the right-hand tradition of Sri Vidya worship is more common. And there are temples, there are gurus, there are teachers. If you know where to go and if you're ready and if they think you're ready, they will give you the initiation.
What's your take on this issue of whether Westerners are distorting Tantra, taking bits out of it, not giving the full picture, and that, you know, the New Ages in particular just don't get it?
Well, the Neo Tantra of the California school definitely seems to look at Tantra as a way to have greater sex and better orgasms. And that seems to miss out on the essence of Tantra, which is to unite the Shakti in our Muladhara with the Shiva in the Sahasrara as a means to spiritual enlightenment. And if that part is de-emphasized, you might as well not call it Tantra anymore.
Thanks very much, Kumar. Professor White, you'd agree with that, I think.
Yes, I would. And I should say that the part of my the issues that I take with the modern tantric sex movement in the United States is that it is ignoring the what could be called the silent tantric majority. I'm not saying the majority of Hindus are tantric, but there are far more Indians practicing Tantra than there are Californians. And they are persons like your last caller who are practicing in places like South India, where Sri Vidya, this particular soft tantric tradition, is quite prevalent. Also in Nepal, which you mentioned briefly, Owen, where the state ceremonial has been a tantric one for several centuries, actually the public religion that the king, as the head of the constitutional democracy, is the main player in, is a tantric religion. So Tantra is not always something that is underground or relegated to villages. It's also present in the sorts of practices that your last caller mentioned, and also in the state ceremonial of places like the Kathmandu Valley and the island of Bali in Indonesia, which is also Hindu and very much tantric.
Just time for one more call. Let's go to Gillian from Brooklyn, Massachusetts.
Hello there. I'm very much enjoying the show. I'm calling because I've been studying tantra basically in the as called Kundalini yoga for about the last 10 years from South India also, and I've been studying in the States for some time too. And the way that I've learned it is really more of a transformation of the sex energy, of purifying it and bringing it up the spinal cord, following the teachings of Sir Woodruff, Arthur Avalon, and so on. And I think this whole sort of, I guess, the media's reaction to it as just sex and everything else is a complete distortion of the fact.
Not the connection.
No, not the connection, definitely.
Splendid. Okay, Professor, quick response to that.
Well, it's a point that's well taken. In fact, I think much of the Kundalini practice, this internal yogic practice, is or was an internalization of practices that occurred outside of the body or between one's own body and other bodies. And this was part of a general move towards internalization that occurred in the 11th, 12th centuries. And really, Hatha Yoga or Kundalini Yoga is a direct offshoot of that internalization process.
Professor Doniger, much as you might have your doubts about the New Agers, do you think they are producing interest in this issue, interest which scholars like you can benefit from?
I think interest is always a good thing, and awareness of Americans that there are other religious traditions other than the ones that they grew up in has to be a good thing. I just want them to go a little farther and a little deeper. Once they are aroused, if I may use the word of Tantra, once their interest is aroused, I'd like them to follow up and go back to the Indian sources and not simply settle for the American versions of it.
Professor Doniger, thank you very much. Professor Doniger is the Distinguished Professor of History of Religions at the University of Chicago. And thanks also to Professor David White, who is the author of Kiss of the Yogini, Tantric Sex in its South Asian Context. If you want to get more on this, take a look at our website, www.theconnection.org. I'm Owen Bennett-Jones. That was The Connection.